I'm Mark Caro, and welcome to episode 130 of Caro Pop, sponsored by Revolution Brewing. If this week's guest, Bruce Botnick, had done only his work on Love's Forever Changes and the Beach Boys' Pet Sounds and Good Vibrations, he'd already be an all-time great in my book, but Botnick is most renowned for engineering all six of the Doors' studio albums with Jim Morrison and producing the swan song, L.A. Woman, after regular producer Paul Rothchild famously walked out. Don't you love her? Working in his Dolby Atmos-equipped studio in the Los Angeles area, Botnick continues to prepare Doors releases, and a major one is arriving this record store day, April 20th. That's when Rhino Records is releasing the 3LP or 2CD package live at Concert Huset, Stockholm, September 20th, 1968. This release contains two live sets from that night, with some songs repeating, often in dramatically contrasting renditions, such as 5 to 1, Love Me Two Times, and Light My Fire. Others are unique to each show, including rare live versions of Your Lost Little Girl, Love Street, and a cover of Mack the Knife. The performances capture the Doors at full strength, with Morrison's voice still clear and powerful as the band tours behind its third album, Waiting for the Sun. That followed the bluesy self-titled debut album and the more psychedelic follow-up, Strange Days, both from 1967. The live Stockholm recording originated as a radio broadcast, and Botnick tells of how the tapes showed up only recently. What kind of shape were they in? What did he have to do to prepare them for release? How was the show recorded? What struck him most when he first heard these performances? Botnick also recalls his history with the band, how he worked with them as an engineer on the first five studio albums and hung out with them on the road. They were peers and friends. Then came the LA Woman sessions. There have been many accounts of why Rothchild quit early in the project. Botnick sets the record straight, explaining the role that Janis Joplin played and naming the song that Rothchild dismissed as cocktail music. Botnick also discusses how the band related to him in a different way from Rothchild, and he recounts changes he made to their recording routines for L.A. Woman, including bringing in a bassist and second guitarist. Had anyone ever suggested to the Doors that they hire a bassist instead of having Ray Manzarek play the bass parts on the organ with his left hand? Did the band dynamic among Morrison, Manzarek, guitarist Robbie Krieger, and drummer John Densmore change much over the years? What kind of shape was Morrison in as they recorded L.A. Woman? What is Botnick's theory for why Morrison died in Paris just 2.5 months after the album's release? One fellow L.A. band that had a huge influence on the Doors was Elektra label mate Love, led by the brilliant mercurial Arthur Lee. Love guitarist Johnny Eccles illuminated much about Love and Lee in a previous Caro Pop episode, and Botnick was right there, again engineering with producer Paul Rothchild before co-producing with Lee Love's landmark third album, Forever Changes. Did Lee run a studio session similarly to how another unpredictable genius, the Beach Boys' Brian Wilson, had done so on Pet Sounds and Good Vibrations? Wouldn't it be nice? Why did Botnick bring the LA musicians known as the Wrecking Crew from those Beach Boys sessions to work on Forever Changes, at least at first? Botnick also has a very specific plea regarding the original Forever Changes master tapes. Can you help? Please enjoy this Caro Pop conversation with Bruce Botnick. And so the story ended. You know it all so well. Oh, shit, you need, I'll tell you. Got into the band Love when I was in high school. That was before my time, but I was very much like a 60s music file.
Yeah, I really love Arthur. I think he was brilliant. I mean, like he and Morrison, you know, two poets.
Right. And Jim Morrison was really, I mean, the Doors were very influenced by Love also, weren't they?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's one of the reasons they signed with Elektra was because Love was there and the Paul Butterfield Blues Band. And Corner Ran Glover, which was one of Robbie's favorites.
Yeah, you can hear in some of, you know, Jim Morrison singing too, like Forever Changes is a much more acoustic, gentle record. But, you know, DiCapo in the first one, you could hear some of those yelps and things that Arthur Lee is doing that, you know, I would assume Jim Morrison was paying attention to.
Well, you know, it's really interesting because when we recorded Forever Changes, couldn't get into Sunset Sound. I mean, that was my home. So we went over to what was Western Recorders, which was another set of studios that had been converted from a radio studio, big room. And we recorded the basic tracks there and Arthur singing live, you know, to catch it. And in Studio 2, Benny Goodman from back in the in the day was recording, and he came in. And he stood there listening to what was going on. And he said, he understands jazz.
Interesting. He
said, you know, so I then he left before I could, you know, he could meet Arthur and Arthur could meet him. But I thought that was really great.
Wow, the idea of Benny Goodman and Arthur Lee in a room together, a studio together, is not like something I would have ever imagined.
You know, we were all children of that era, so luckily we had all that music. I mean, radio in those days, and they played everything. You had your local station, they would play Sinatra, they played The Doors, they'd play Ella Fitzgerald, they'd play, you know, Patti Page, you know, and novelty songs, all on the same station.
Right.
It was not like we have today, which is narrow casting. You know, every station is defined as a hip hop station or an adult contemporary, you know, or just heavy metal station. And so it's not surprising to me that Arthur or even in Jim Morrison would have that to fall back on, those influences.
Right. And also time gets sort of stretched out, but like 1967, you know, if you go back 15 years, rock doesn't even exist. So, you know, the idea of, you know, knowing these older pop singers and jazz singers and everything else, it's like, well, Elvis didn't even start till what, 54 or 56, mm-hmm. when people started hearing him more broadly. So, you know, you go back 15 years from now and, you know, it's like, okay, 2009, music doesn't sound that much different. But, you know, back then it was just a total world different.
Right. I mean, it's when I was teaching at USC, University of Southern Comfort, no, Southern California. Anyway, I'd always open up the semester and talk a little bit of history. And I remember there were 14 students, and I mentioned the Beatles, and I saw blank looking at me.
Oh, no. Parents aren't doing their jobs if you're getting blank looks.
Yeah, so I said, wait a minute, how many of you know of the Beatles? One hand went up, and I said, okay. And this is not long ago. He said, I think my parents like them. And a year later, Apple started streaming the Beatles, and then everybody knew. But
that's
shocking,
good.
Because had they had radio that covered the gamut of styles of music, country and novelty and whatever, they would have known.
Yeah, well, it's true. Growing up in the 70s, I mean, you'd hear Lady Marmalade next to Walk This Way, the not Run DMC version,
right.
You know, next to some, you know, Alone Again Naturally or Carpenters. And but on the other hand, everything is available now. But my girls know, they not only know the Beatles well, but they know Forever Changes well, because parents like to play that one.
Crazy.
Exactly. Yeah. So when you were recording that, did you start off with Arthur and the Wrecking Crew before the rest of the band came back in? Because I know there are those three songs that are not, you know, the rest of the band.
Yeah, I've talked about this before, but when it became time to do the album, the band couldn't have been more disinterested. So I thought, well, heck, I'm doing a lot with the Wrecking Crew. I'll get them in. 1 3-hour date, we'll get a couple of songs. Arthur played acoustic guitar, and John, he played his electric, I think, you know, an intersperse. And the rest of the band sat on the control room, and the control men, a couple of them were actually weeping, because they realized they had screwed up. And that shocked them into getting their act together, and that's how we got the album.
Right. Yeah, I actually had Johnny Eccles on talking about that as well. And he was reminding me that he was still on those other songs. Did you know the Wrecking Crew from Pet Sounds? Because you did some stuff on, you worked
on
that
too, right?
Yeah, I
did. I recorded a tremendous amount of stuff. I did a lot of stuff on Pet Sounds. I did the track on Good Vibration.
Wow.
The vocals were done at United Western Studios, Studio 3.
So you had a lot of experience with these sort of eccentric geniuses in the studio.
Yeah, I'm blessed.
I would agree with you, given Pet Sounds is and you know, I mean, that's another favorite all-time record. Like Brian Wilson running a session versus Arthur Lee, like what's the, like how did they, and similarities, differences?
No. Arthur was, took a different position with Arthur, which was to, if he would have a lyric, I can't remember, I think there's a bluebird on the branch, and da 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 da, and he sang it, and the line didn't make any sense to me, and I said, "Did you mean?" And he said, "Yeah." So we had that kind of a thing going, but basically, he was in the room all the time with the band. Most of it was live in the studio. We did do some overdubs. We of course, the orchestra, the strings,
right,
and did some of the electric guitar solos up at Leon Russell's house. Hmm. And Leon had in his freezer ready-made scrambled eggs and bacon. So you got hungry, went to the freezer, and he had one of these newfangled microwaves that none of us had seen and probably got radiated.
That's very funny. Like, because it takes so long to scramble an egg, you should have some in the freezer.
Yeah.
So is the bulk of the work you're doing now stuff like this new Doors live package? Or?
Well, that, and I just finished some work with Joni Mitchell and Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young, and, you know, a bunch of stuff. And
what was that
some,
work?
Some Disney stuff for their High School Musical. I got to be 13 years old again. It's great.
Nice. What was the Joni and Crosby, Stills, Nash stuff you're doing?
Mixing blue in Atmos.
Oh, okay.
So I'm going back with, you know, do the older stuff.
What do you think of the Atmos? Is it just like a leap in, you know?
If you can listen to it, as you have in my pictures there, where it's, you know, around you and everything, you immerse, especially on a live show, it's spectacular. It's 3D. Majority is on headphones, and it does improve it. It doesn't give you that, you know, exactly where things are, but it doesn't matter. It's in a lot of cases, we've been able to go back and mix things with a little bit more modern sensibility, and the stuff just sounds better.
So how do you define more modern sensibility?
We hear things different today. It's plain and simple. Why? I mean, I'm not 19 years old anymore. You know, how I used to record and how I heard things are different today.
I mean, like when Giles Martin's doing those Beatles ones and making those quote unquote modern, I mean, he's not like adding, you know, synthesizers to them, but in general, it seems like a lot of stuff that's being updated, the vocals are a little more present. The bass is a little more present, a little uh-huh. more defined. Like those seem to me to be the two main issues.
Yeah, that's basically it. We view things differently today, and that's okay. The Doors albums, all the studio albums are in Atmos, and those albums, and they're now coming out on Blu-ray in Atmos. In a lot of cases, I'd add verses or chorus, put in vocals that we couldn't use because of AM radio, and then you couldn't cross the fuck barrier. So, as Paul Rothschild so aptly put it. So we were able to realize. So the kitchen sink is on those Atmos mixes.
Well, it's interesting because like the Doors first album, and I got the Vinyl Me Please mono edition that you had remastered. I know you'd also overseen an Analog Productions, I think 2x45 right. stereo version of it. And right. and I've seen, you know, interviews with you where you're talking about whether to sort of preserve it the way people remember it or whether to fix it. So for instance, the speed of Light My Fire and mm-hmm. is it the end?
The end.
And yeah,
the
those end. Are both wrong. They're both too slow. And I know for those editions, at least, you sort of left them because this is like your kind of archival version of it, as opposed to maybe the version you wanted, which would be like, it was meant
to
be faster.
I still want to do that. I still want to use the Plangent process to resolve the speed and the pitch. I mean, it's because it's not 440. It's a quarter tone flat, and which is sad. The story, and I think I've talked about it before. So a professor at some college noted it, that why was the single of Light My Fire on pitch and on speed, but yet on the album it's running a quarter tone flat? And that was because we used to put what they call a wrap, some splicing tape on the capstan of where the puck, which was the rubber, went up against and pulled the tape through across the tape heads, right? So we put a wrap on there to speed it up for radio so that it would be a little brighter. Mm. And by doing that, we accidentally brought it up in pitch and never even knew it.
But the version that's on the album, that's flat. That's not like correct. It's actually running too slow for some reason.
I mean, yeah, the original album on vinyl is, and some of the CDs is all running at the slower speed. And we did put out DVD 5.1 surround mixes years ago, and I did new stereos at that time, and those are running on speed, but I'd really like to go back to the master tapes and fix them.
Right. And then there's the break on through thing where like the early versions have She Get and then
High.
Some later ones, She Get High. And I remember the first time hearing on the radio, hearing him go, She Get High. And I'm like, wait a minute, where'd that word come from? I've never heard that because I just grown up listening to the other version. And it seems like some of them now have that and some of them don't.
Right. Yeah. It's being that we only really had six albums. There's so many permutations that have come out over the years. What has it been, 50 years now?
It's been 50 years since, it's been more than 50 years since LA Woman came out, which was the last one. So,
yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, 67 was the first one. So, coming up on, you know, 57 years.
Yeah, we're getting there.
I know, getting there. This Doors Live Stockholm concert that's coming out for Record Store Day. Right. Do you have at this point, or does someone send you like a whole bunch of different Doors live performances and recordings of them, and you're able to say, oh, you know what, this one will be good, this one maybe not so much? I mean, this was originally a radio broadcast, but I'm sort of wondering, like, what kind of live archive is there, and how are you guys sort of choosing like what to put out?
That's kind of difficult because there are a lot of bootleg recordings, and this is probably one of the only recordings of the Doors early in their career and that was recorded professionally. You know, it wasn't done on a cassette machine and something like that, or a cassette off of in those days, sound reinforcement didn't exist.
Right.
There was a microphone, two microphones, for Jim and Ray. And they were going into, their road manager had a little mixer and it would play them through amps on the stage. Same thing with the Doors. So they balanced. So the Doors were not loud. They weren't a loud band because they didn't have sound reinforcement. So that's what how it was in those days. The sound came from the stage, from the band playing live. And sometimes there was a microphone and there was a PA loudspeaker. But anyway, this was recorded on 4-track quarter inch. I don't know how it happened, but I guess somebody going through the vaults at Swedish Radio found it and sent it to the Doors. And we got it and we listened to it and blown away because it was the early days for Jim. You can hear his voice is silky. It's warm. He's crooning where he needs to. He was an enormous fan of Frank Sinatra. And he knew about, because of the music from the 40s and the 50s, he knew about crooning. But he also could go from crooning to screaming. I mean, he was like Ema Sumac. He could hit from the floor to the ceiling. But anyway, when we got this tape, it was extraordinarily good. And Ray Manzarek told a story about, I guess, the night before, or two nights before in Denmark, where when they were on the road with the airplane, that Jim would walk down the street with them and somebody would come up, "Hey, man, here's something. Take this." And Jim took it and it might have been acid. Who knows what it was. But they were getting ready to go on stage. And he literally, as Ray said, Jim was against the wall. His eyes started to roll up in his head and he's just slowly slid down the wall and passed out. And couldn't perform. So Ray did all the singing at that concert. So this one was the next concert, and it was damn good.
It was the comeback show. Yeah. And they did two shows that night, too, because there's early one and late one. So some of them, there are two versions of, and then some of them, you know, they mixed up the set a little bit. And it's actually fascinating to hear them do, you know, two versions of the same song. Like the first song on there is the album closer from Waiting for the Sun, which is 5-1. And, you know, I think the second version is like 3 minutes longer than the first one. And he just keeps vamping on, you know, Get Together One More Time.
Right.
And it made me sort of, you know, wonder just like how much the band really just sort of fed off on like, all right, what's Jim doing? You know, okay, he's going to stretch this one out this time.
Well, they normally wouldn't have a set list. They would start with a medley of sorts and then figure out what they wanted to play from that point on. So it was totally, and it was a group decision. You know, Jim would say this, or Ray would say that. This, I'm really feeling good about this. Let's do that. So that's why the two sets are the same, but they're different. You know, sequencing, the addition of other songs. And then it was very normal. That's the way the Doors performed.
Right. They did When the Music's Over in both of them. They did The End in just one of them. They did like Love Street and Your Lost Little Girl, which my impression is there weren't a ton of live performances of those songs.
I mean, when they did the Hollywood Bowl, they opened with Music's Over. When we went on the road to do the Absolutely Live album in, you know, Pittsburgh and Philadelphia and Detroit and New York and L.A., even Paul afterwards wished that we hadn't done it the way we did it. Went out with a set list because Paul wanted to get multiple performances of a song, so that we could choose between it, maybe edit, you know, to get the best performance.
Right.
Rather than go out, tonight, let's do the Doors. And then the second show, let's do Strange Days. You know what I mean? To do the albums. That would have been great to have today.
Mm.
You know, complete, like, and probably had, I mean, they, you know, a lot of those songs they hadn't played. I mean, that's why Stockholm is so good, because it's mainly music from the first album or the initial 25 songs that Jim wrote.
Right. Is after Waiting for the Sun. So you got The Doors, Strange Days, Waiting for the Sun, and kind of a good, you know, combination of all those. But yeah, you have these, you know, the sort of the set pieces are those, you know, Light My Fire and The End and When the Music's Over, these kind of big epics they were doing. In the second Light My Fire, which really cooks, there's a part where Morrison says to the crowd, "Why don't you jump up my ass? I mean it, man. What do you come here for anyway?" Do you have any idea what was going on at that point?
Free association.
He was, someone in the audience was ticking him off, although he wouldn't have used the word tick, I don't think.
Yeah, well, he hadn't. If you listen to the New York recordings, that we did put that out, and he got into a thing with David Peel from David Peel in the Lower East Side,
right?
And you know, rapping with him, and he loved to do that. If somebody was smart in the audience, I mean, you know, had their gray matter was good, he would he'd get off on it. But yeah. He just enjoyed it. He enjoyed the interplay.
What would you say was the band's peak as a band?
Peak as a band.
Like, it seems like this is sort of in the...
Are you talking about live or in the studio or both?
Both. You can... Were you seeing them a lot live at the time, by the way? Because obviously you're in the studio with them, but you're also...
In those days when they would be playing up at the Avalon and... In San Francisco or Winterland, you know, I could get to the airport in 15 minutes, fly to San Francisco for $7, right?
Wow.
And get a car for another $7 and go to see the gig and then fly back that night. But I did that a lot, you know, wherever they, at least in going up to San Francisco. But in those days, it was really loose and it was really enjoyable, really enjoyable. Before it became a day job is probably the best thing I can say with an artist.
Yeah, because there are a lot of people who it's like, you know what, I've spent all this time with him. We just made this record and, you know, they could go do their shows. I'm going to go home and, you know, watch TV or something. But so for you to be flying up to San Francisco to see them when you're already spending so much time with them, I mean, that's a certain dedication to what they're doing.
I mean, I did go on the road with them a couple times. And, you know, the whole thing was after a while, it's just, what are you going to do after the gig? You're not going to go back to your hotel room and watch TV. So, you know, you go out with the girls and have fun.
Hmm. What was it about the band that made you want to spend so much time with them?
Well, we were just same age, friends. We became friends. I wasn't the producer, so I was kind of on the same level that they were. It's difficult sometimes, I think, for producers to be friends long-term with an artist. Because especially if they're having to be the cop.
Right.
And I wasn't in that position with them, and I still am.
Yeah, I mean, you engineered all their albums and then wound up producing L.A. Woman when Paul Roth's album left. And with them. And, you know, and at that point, it probably felt more like, hey, the cop just left. let's just make this album with our friend.
Yeah, that was kind of it. Paul was terrific, but he had gone through Pearl.
The Janis Joplin album.
Janis Joplin. And he and Pearl were really in love with one another. And she died. It freaked him out. Really did. It had been really tough keeping Jim interested and alive. And that's probably because the guys really got to the point where they didn't want to be produced anymore. And they didn't need a producer. They needed somebody to help them realize what was going on. So come L.A. Woman, in the rehearsals, Paul sat there and he was mortified with what he was hearing. Because there was no inspiration I mean, the guys were looking at it. Oh, here we go again. We're going to have to do it this way. You know, it's sort of like the Beatles when they made Let It Be, you know, kind of thing. And when the Stones wound up producing themselves and the Who, and, you know, it's just that way where you don't need that somebody. You need the somebody to be able to go, hey, that was good. Or do you think we could do another take? I mean, just, and then we'll edit that piece in. Anyway, we went into the studio at Sunset Sound to try and resurrect album, the first album, The Feeling. And Paul immediately put his head in his hands and said, I can't do this anymore. Because he was, you know, in his head, and he had been in that room with Janis, you know, so it was tough.
Right.
My heart went out to him.
And Jim was being sort of self-destructive at that point, so it probably felt like deja vu.
He was. If I remember correctly, that one day, Jim was totally sober. I mean, Jim didn't like authority. I mean, his father was a general, you know, I mean, an admiral in the Navy. And he didn't particularly care for authority. And Paul represented authority. It could have been anybody, not just Paul. Paul's not the bad guy here, by any means. And he just, so he, you know, he said, I can't do this. And we all went to dinner, hugged and kissed. He went off, and we decided we're going to do this together. And I asked them where they feel most comfortable, and they said in their rehearsal room. And I said, great, I'll get some gear and we'll go in there and record. And I suggested Mark Benno on guitar so that Robbie could play live his solos and not have to do any overdubs. The whole idea was to try to get it live.
Right.
To try to get them to get back to who they are and who they were. And I brought in Jerry Scheff, who was the bass player on that album,
right.
Mark's album that I was doing, Minnows.
And Elvis Presley.
Yeah, and I mentioned it to Jim, and Jim just went, yeah, because he loved Elvis. So that it all worked, you know. And the thing in making music is to leave yourself room for things to happen. Good things, bad things. Just leave yourself room and just let it flow. Don't the old adage of don't think, it's dangerous. And we tried not to think. We just went with it. There's very few takes on songs, and it's basically live performances. Just a few overdubs here and there, but otherwise live in the studio. And that's getting back to the first album.
When Paul was listening and saying he couldn't do it anymore, was he reacting to the songs or the performance of the songs or just the vibe in the studio or all of the above?
He was responding to Riders on the Storm, and he said, this is Cocktail Jazz.
Right. The song's held up, though.
Oh, it is. Every time it rains, it's on the radio. And in Atmos, it's wonderful because the thunder is overhead and it moves and the rain surrounds you. It's not really loud, but it's, you know, it's what it is.
That's interesting because that does go down as one of their classic songs. But I'd read that he was reacting to Love Her Madly. And then I was like, no, it was Riders on the Storm. But, you know, that the Riders on the Storm made more sense as the Cocktail Jazz comment. But
yeah, well, that's where it was. But he had, you know, there were so many things that were troubling him. And the Doors were only part of it.
Right.
So, you know, he knows that. Even though he passed, he and I had talked about it a lot.
So, yeah, and Jim Morris's voice is, it's definitely much deeper and growlier on that record than it is, you know, by the time, you know, a few years earlier.
Smoking cigarettes, drinking a lot, you know, and it's kind of a thing, and I think I know what he died of. When you're heavy into a project and you really don't have time to give yourself and your body a little chance to recover, you know, to relax. And he was pretty intense. I mean, I had it on when I'd be doing a movie score, and we had 3.5 days to really do it and nail it. And all kinds of hours, crazy hours, or having to get an album out, that when I'd finish, I could count on getting a cold, getting sick. And a lot of the people that I work with, same thing happened. And I've seen people collapse. And this could have happened to Jim when we finished LA Woman and he took off for Paris and he had no more responsibility. He knew he didn't have to go on the road again. He didn't have to make another album. He didn't have to do anything but just relax. And I think when he relaxed, his body shut down. That's what happened. That's what I think.
When he left, were you worried about him?
Was I worried about him?
Yeah, I mean, always. Did you have a feeling like, oh, this might be the last Doors album, or, you know, and also might be the last time I see him?
Well, it was the last Doors album contractually that the Doors had to do. So whether there was going to be another album, I don't know. I think that we all thought, and I've talked to the guys about it, that maybe he would have been inspired because he loved the way that LA Woman came out. I mean, he had a real good time. He was never drunk. He was there all the time through everything and never messed up and very positive. And then maybe he would have, you know, if he had lived through it, he would have come back and said, you know, let's do another one, you know, this way. I really enjoyed that. And then he maybe would have said, hey, let's go out and do a gig, one gig. You know, who knows?
Right.
We'll never know.
Were you shocked when you heard the news about him?
Oh, yeah. But not surprised.
Yeah.
I mean, there were numerous times when we were amazed that he was still alive.
Well, the music in your special.
Carol Pop is supported by Revolution Brewing, Illinois' largest independent brewery. Now that the weather is warming up, Revolution's premium lager, Cold Time, really hits the spot. It's an all-malt beer featuring Midwest two-row barley, Mexican lager yeast, a touch of German hops, and pure Great Lakes water. It's never pasteurized, and the brewed low and slow badge on the can attests to a slower, lower-temperature fermentation that mellows the beer for a smoother, more flavorful sip. Cold Time is available in 12 packs of 12-ounce cans. Then you're getting these, you know, live recordings that you haven't heard. What about them maybe surprised you the most or just impressed you the most, you know, after just not having heard those recordings before?
Oh, you mean Stockholm?
Stockholm, yeah, or any of the other things you've heard since then.
You know, the thing that I love about them, if they're far enough back, is there's the freshness and the youth behind it, and that it isn't a day job and they're really enjoying it. And the thought of, I want to be a rock and roll star, didn't exist. They just wanted, you know, be able to play their music. And it made me think about the years that they spent playing in clubs, which was where they developed their songs, you know, arranged them and performed them in front of people and got a feel. I mean, when Jim started out, he wouldn't face the audience because he was so insecure about what it was, who he was, and in being able to perform on the stage. A well-known artist that I was in talks with about possibly producing, he said to me, and I've heard this from other artists, and if Jim was around, I'm sure, and I know what he would have said, which is they don't, the artist doesn't know who's coming to see them. Are they coming to see Jimbo or are they coming to see Jim Morrison? And do they even know who Jim Morrison is? It could be the same thing with Bob Dylan. You know what I mean? Are they coming to see Bob Dylan or Robert Zimmerman? And a lot of artists feel that way, that the audience doesn't have a clue as to who they are. And they're, when they go on the stage, they're this person and they're this thing. And Jim always, I mentioned it to him, I mean, we were talking about it, and he says, I feel like a monkey with an organ grinder.
Hmm. What was his relationship like with the other three musicians, and did that change over the years, or were they all...
Well, I mean, the more messed up he got, yeah, it was difficult. But, I mean, there were a lot of quiet, private times that were good. I mean, I was a big... I still am a fan of movies. And I was had dated a girl that was with a company called Films Incorporated, which had all the movies on 16 millimeter, generally for shut-ins. You know, you could rent them. And I would do that. I'd rent three movies for a weekend. And sometimes Jim would come over and lay on the floor and run movies. Because he was a huge fan.
Do you remember movies you watched with him?
I think Citizen Kane was one. We all love that.
Yeah, it's a good one.
Yeah, I can't remember. A lot of movies. And I was doing a lot of work for American International Pictures, and they did the Beach Party movies. And I was recording Annette Funicello at the time. So I had access to their library of a lot of their horror movies, their, you know, their B and C films, Invasion of the Saucer Men, you know, things like that.
Right.
It was fun to watch that stuff.
And you were recording some stuff for Disney?
Yeah, I did a lot for Disney.
So, yeah, you had from Disney to the Doors.
Yeah, well, no, you got to understand. It's like I was talking about radio. You did everything. I mean, my normal day, like when I started with the Doors' first album, was commercials for, you know, like Hertz. I'd do commercials in the morning, and then I would do children's recording because that was the house that Disneyland Records lived. Tutti Camerata, who built Sunset Sound and owned it, he was the musical director for Disneyland Records and the producer of Annette Funicello and other things.
Right.
And so I would do children's records, storytellers, you know, like 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea with six actors. And then he'd do the music and we'd make these storytellers. And then at late afternoon, it was usually 8 to like 9:30 for the commercials, and then 10 to 1 with the children, and then 2 to 5 or 2 to 6 doing rock and roll. We didn't record in the evening in those days. It was more expensive.
So you'd send the Doors home at 6?
We were in the afternoon. I mean, because they had to go to the Whiskey, and they were the house band. So sometimes they'd come back. But we did that album in four and a half days. Same thing with L.A. Woman.
So to go back to my question about when they peaked, like it seems like the Stockholm Life thing is sort of in that sweet spot where, you know, Jim's voice still sounds great.
And, oh, yeah.
You know, so that's like around 68. Is this around when the band is peaking as a live band or just as a band in the studio, would you say? Or was there some other?
No, they were I mean, 68, that's when I got married. We had already put out Strange Days. So we were recording Waiting for the Sun. So they were at the top at that particular point in time, if you were to. But his voice still was not gone. It was not gone. And it's a joy for me to listen to because the quality and the sensitivity that's there.
He was such a larger-than-life figure and also was having all these headlines about, you know, various things that were happening on stage or not on stage. And I'm just sort of wondering, you know, at some point, does the rest of the band feel like, you know, they're being overshadowed? Because one of the great things about listening to this live thing...
There wasn't that dynamic. That dynamic, it wasn't Jim Morrison and the Doors. It was the Doors. four for one, all for one, you know.
Because part of what was striking me listening to this live record is just like, I mean, they're very good musicians, which obviously we know.
Oh, yeah.
But, you know,
Listen to John. John was very much in sync with Jim. I mean, you hear that he's not just up there playing rhythm. He's playing the song and responding to Jim, because Jim was always very freeform, you know, within limits.
Right.
You know, it's like jazz, where, you know, you play a couple choruses of the melody and then you go off and start jamming, you know? And that's literally where they were.
Yeah, and it's just the four of them on stage in this, right? There's no, like, extra musicians.
No, and there's just Vince Traynor, the road manager, up there with the little mixer controlling the voice. And, you know, that was it. It was pretty cool.
And Ray's playing bass with his left hand.
Left hand. And because of all those years of doing that, he went totally deaf in his left ear.
Really?
Well, he was turning sideways to the speakers, right?
Oh, okay.
So, and the organ could be loud, but they only went on stage with one amp for the bass, one amp for the organ, which was a Vox. Robbie had one amp, Fender Twin, and they had another amp for Jim's and Ray's voice. That was it. Self-contained.
I'm sure this has come up a million times, but did people say to them, like either you guys or someone else say, you know, why don't you guys just get a bassist?
Oh, I'm sure they did. We had Lefty. We had Ray and Lefty. And Lefty was this guy, his left hand. That's what he called it. And the fact that he was able to cut himself in half is really kind of normal with piano players. But they never, you know.
Your rhythm section in your left hand and all the melodic stuff with your right at the same time.
Yeah.
It is kind of crazy.
It's pretty amazing. Pretty amazing if you think about it.
Yeah, and I talked to this jazz keyboardist, Delvon Lamar. It was a while ago by now, but I think, you know, he always had a trio, and it was him, a guitarist and a drummer, and he was sort of doing the bass parts with his left hand too. So, and he's a jazz soul guy. So,
yeah, I mean, the fact that you can do that, it just boggles my mind.
And most of what you do, I assume, is in the digital realm at this point.
Yes, but we have in our vault all the master tapes, and at a place called Hollywood Vaults, where the air is treated, kept at a precise temperature, and the tapes survive. I mean, I'm able to go back and play these tapes that are now 50 years old, amazingly enough, but we've been transferring them to very high resolution digital, 384, 32 bits, to try and capture everything. And the only problem we have is with digital today, there's no way to archive it for history, because the hard drives fall apart.
Right. And the technology keeps changing.
Yeah. And if they do survive, what kind of mechanism are you going to be able to use to get the music off of them? It even goes to putting in optical, and optical rots. So at this point, analog is still the best storage medium long term.
But if you were preparing something to be heard today.
Oh, it's digital, absolutely.
It's optimal to have some sort of digital step in there, because there's obviously a sizable group of people now who, like, we want AAA, all analog steps. And then there are some who are like, no, you need to, it depends on the condition of the tapes. You want to be able to do some fixes and stuff. Combination of both?
I mean, digital is much easier to work with. You can, and automation-wise, it's spectacular. I mean, back in the day, not too long ago, we didn't have automation. So I had to memorize, let's say in the case of the Doors, all four of them, five, including Lefty. Memorize every part, every bar, every beat of what they were playing, and then so that I could mix and make the moves, right? Today, I can write a master pass with the balance the way it is, then go through and update it. And I can even draw it on the screen to correct things. I mean, there's so many more variables. To give you an example, if you listen to the end, you'll notice that the whole character of the recording changes about halfway through. And that's because the second take, Ray had his amplifier on his organ, his Vox organ, on in the studio. The first take, he didn't. He was using headphones to hear himself. And all of a sudden, it blooms. The sound blooms. And so to make that work, his bass part came in a little staggered. And it's not like in digital where you can digitally cut around things. But there we had and it was 4-track, 1/2-inch, a solution that you could paint onto the oxide, which is the magnetic particles, and it could show you the tracks visually. And we literally marked the tape and cut it and spliced them together. And if we screwed up, there was no tomorrow. Wrecked the tape. We were lucky. But it worked. But today, digitally, sky's the limit. You can do anything. And restoration-wise, it's fabulous. When we did the Hollywood Bowl, I didn't have that luxury on Stockholm, where Jim's mic is off for part of, I think, Music's Over on one of the shows. Not there. And I debated about whether to grab his vocal from the other show and fill in the holes where they're missing. And I played with it a little bit. And I went, nah, this is not honest, being honest. You know, we're going to have to, I'll just, in my notes, I'll mark that his mic stopped working then. So in the Hollywood Bowl, to make that work, I did go to all the live shows and took a word here and a word there, or a sentence here, and kept trying different words to fit his body language when he was singing so that it was real. And today I defy you, if you see the show, to see that there was no microphone. It's in there. And I could only do that in the digital world. To do it in analog would have been a nightmare.
Is that something that AI is going to do in the future?
Probably.
Are you looking forward to the AI world?
I've already looked at it, actually. Not in audio, but in a friend of mine who's a professor at University of Santa Barbara, UC. And he had it at his house. And so I think I said, he said, give me something off the top of your head. I said, well, how about Jim Morrison in a chocolate room with strawberries? And it made this drawing where it got because there's a million pictures of Morrison up there on the web, and strawberries and chocolate and rooms. Sure. So it did it. And I was like, I want to have that to play with.
Right. Well, then you're going to have Jim Morrison from the first album singing the LA Woman album. And that'll be like the next thing people will do.
Oh, God. Well, let's hope not. It would be interesting.
I've heard versions of, like the last Paul McCartney album. And there's like AI versions of those songs sung by young Paul McCartney. And it's kind of creepy. I don't know. I don't like not knowing what I'm listening to, but I also understand the attraction of it.
Yeah, let's go back to the first album. Let's go back to the end. That's running a quarter of a tone flat. If you bring it up, he gets younger.
Sure.
You slow it down, you get a little, your voice gets deeper. That's a case where you can hear that. And I mean, you see CGI done making actors look younger. Harrison Ford, they just did in the last
The Indiana Jones movie and The Irishman with De Niro, which didn't really work so well because he moved like he was his own age and then his face was more like he was 40. But they're going to get better at it, though. That's the thing. They're going to get better at it.
I remember years ago, George Lucas said he would love nothing better than to be able to have his actors electronically and not have to deal with them.
Right. What else is in these Doors vaults? Like, what other great performances have we not heard that you're going to work
on
for next
year?
Something
there. I can't be definitive because I really don't know. I mean, Stockholm popped up out of nowhere.
When did you guys get that?
A year ago.
Really? Mm-hmm. So that recent. Interesting.
Yeah. Or maybe longer. But I mean, I didn't really know about it until maybe a year ago. It was a pleasant surprise. I mean, I'd love for the New Orleans concert and I think the Dallas, Texas concert, which was the last one where Jim was singing then and he just sat down on the riser, John's riser, and just stopped. He couldn't do it anymore.
Mm.
And this was after L.A. Woman.
Right.
So,
you'd like that to come out. There is a recording of it. It just hasn't been released.
We haven't gotten it. Nobody's given it to us. And then if they do have it and they want us to have it, they want a tremendous sum of money rather than, because these things, you know, are special editions. And there are a lot of Doors fans out there that would love to have them. So why not share them?
Right. So who is it who
Getting
has
back
these?
To, since you've got this podcast, and I'll make a request.
Okay.
The original 8-track masters for Forever Changes have been lost for the last 30 or 40 years. I'm convinced that they're in somebody's private vault.
Really?
There are a lot of collectors that have stuff. Yeah. And if anybody out there that's listening has it or knows where it is, nothing bad will happen. Just let us get our hands on it and make a digital copy and you can keep it.
Really? I didn't know that. So, because there have been a lot of other issues of that album that have come out. Mobile Fidelity, Rhino has done a few.
I know.
So those are not based on the original masters because those are missing.
Yeah. But, you know, that's a problem because I would love nothing better to go in and remix that album for Atmos, and to give it to Plangent. This company that can resolve the recorded bias frequency in the tape. And what it does is it eliminates the tape so that you're running exactly at the speed of the original master or live performance. And in tune. That's what we'd do with the first Doors album if we ever go back. And I would love to go resolve that whole thing and remix it. I love that album.
How much better would Forever Changes sound to someone like me if you went through all that?
It wouldn't matter better so much. It just because that mix or any of those albums from that era is you capture a moment in time. It's a performance. And it's hard to go back 30, 40, 50 years and be that person with that same sensibility, whatever food you were eating, whether you were drinking wine, whether you were smoking pot, whether you were getting laid. You know, it's hard. Hmm. You can't go back and relive it. You just have to go with how you feel it today and how does the music impact you today. It's all about responding. You know, that's the whole thing with an artist is to allow them to not think and just let it come at the performance.
Right. Well, there's a New York Times story just now about these people who are chasing down these old master recordings. So we need to do that with the Forever Changes.
Yeah, well, there's one. Is that the one about that shows Sunset Sound with Danny White?
That sounds right.
He's a good guy. And basically, they've been going through the vaults at Sunset Sound and probably somewhere else. And I've spoken with Paul Camerata, who is, you know, took over for his father. And I saw, just on the photographs from the article, a lot of tapes with my writing on them. I told myself, I want to come down and see what you got, because there are certain things we're looking for, but I know the Forever Changes is not there. Somebody's got it in their vault.
Well, I'll come out to LA and we'll go look together. That'll be fun.
Okay. But no problem. Don't. Nobody's going to jail. Nobody's going to sue you. If you've got it, do it through an attorney so that, you know, you, nobody knows who you are. Get it to us. We'll make the copy and you'll get it back.
Do you have a favorite album that you've worked on?
All of them. I don't know. It's like I say, who's your favorite child? I can't do that.
Right.
You know, it's an era that you were in. I mean, I'm very fortunate to have been able to record a lot of people and be with them. Had a lot of really good times, had some crazy times. But I look back on it and it's all positive. Even getting fired from a job was positive because it led to a realization and a move forward.
Are you thinking of one in particular?
What, getting fired?
Yeah.
No. You want me to start doing Larry David on you?
Oh, sure. I like Larry David. Now that Curb is all done, I need my reinforcement of Larry David. So,
yeah.
I just was, when you said, you know, getting fired was a learning experience, I didn't know if there was like one in particular you were thinking about.
No, it happens, you know, where you, maybe you, I recorded something and I was scared. Well, I know one album in particular that I was scheduled to produce and went to have the meeting on it. And they said, we decided to do it ourselves. Goodbye. And I was like, oh, okay. And on the way home, I saw this billboard that said Tahiti. So I packed my wife up and we went to Tahiti for 3 weeks.
Well, that sounds good.
So, you know, that's what you got to look at, you know?
And did the album suck? Did it need a producer?
No, it didn't suck. It was his vision. It would have been his vision anyway. It's just that he wanted to do it. He wanted to be the man. So that's fine with that. I'm cool.
Well, there you go.
I mean, when you have the option to get on a plane to go to a tropical island instead, unless you really need the money desperately.
No, Tahiti sounds great.
Island.
I've never been to Tahiti. If you were getting a copy of one of these Doors albums, let's say, or Love for that matter. So you have like, let's say the first album, you could get like a sealed, like a never opened, you know, Monarch pressing of, you know, the Doors first album, or you can have your 45 RPM analog productions, you know, version that you worked on, or one of these other versions. Is which is going to be better, the pristine original or one that you've worked on more recently?
They're both valid for different reasons. The first, and I do have copies of the first album. The thing about that I regret in the regards of the 45 RPM, but the whole thing is in the audiophile world, and there's a push to remaster them again at 33 and a third RPM and not 45 off the original master tapes. And one of the songs, I think it's Your Lost Little Girl, the tape got mangled by somebody. And it's so you can't master off of it, play it. And the tapes are old enough now that I wouldn't really want to run them again if we didn't have to.
Right.
So we don't know whether at the mastering lab, Doug Sachs, famous mastering engineer, whether his two-track machine was really running on speed when we cut the lacquers. And we don't know whether the two-track machine that they mastered from in New York, I think it was at Master Disc, whether that was running on speed. We don't know anything. And so to say that any one is better than the other, probably the one that realizes accurately the speed and in tune and doesn't try to make hip hop out of it, you know, thumping bass drums in it, that just realizes the music as honestly as possible is the best version. And I don't think I've gotten there yet.
Interesting. So, see, well, it gives you something to work for still. Yeah. And would you go mono or stereo on those records?
Well, we have both.
I know
you do. The mono mix is a different mix than the stereo. If you listen to it, they're both valid, totally valid.
And you're not going to choose between the two. You like them both?
No, because they're two different art pieces, you know?
Well, thank you so much. I'm really glad we got to do this. I appreciate it. You've worked on a lot of my favorite music, so I really appreciate it.
Take care, Mark.
This is the end, my friends, of episode 130 of Carol Pop. Thanks so much to Bruce Botnick for going into such great detail about his work with The Doors then and now. Head to your favorite record store early on April 20th for Record Store Day, so you can snag Rhino's limited edition 3LP or 2CD set live at Concert Huset, Stockholm, September 20th, 1968. You could find a lot more Doors releases on Rhino's website as well. Go to store.rhino.com and look up The Doors. Of course, if you don't yet have Love's Forever Changes, get it now. And if you have that album's master tapes, please let us know. Carol Pop is produced by Chris Swake, who knows to turn out the lights when the music's over. Thanks to Jeff Walker for becoming a Carol Pop friend. You can too for a mere $24. Please contribute at carolpop.com and help keep this thing going. Your support is much appreciated. I'm Mark Caro. Please follow Carol Pop on Twitter, X, and Instagram at Carol Popcast. You can follow me as well at Mark Caro, at MarkCaro. Please share this episode, subscribe, tell your friends, and tune in again next week for another Carol Pop Conversation. Thanks.